Peter Stuyvesant. While England was sending colonists to Virginia and France was making a settlement on the St. Lawrence, another European country was planning not to be shut out of the New World. This was Holland. One of her ships under Henry Hudson explored the Hudson River, and soon the Dutch founded trading posts along its banks and extended them almost as far south as where Philadelphia now stands. All this country between the Hudson and the Delaware they called New Netherland. Their most flourishing settlement was on Manhattan Island. This was named New Amsterdam. One morning in May 1647, there was great excitement in the little Dutch village. All the people put on their Sunday clothes and went down to the bank of the East River. "He's coming!" cried someone, and they were so glad they all shouted their welcome, though the vessel was much too far away for the new governor to hear them. It came slowly up the East River and anchored off the fort. Then the cannon blazed out a greeting. The people shouted louder than ever. The governor was rowed ashore and marched up the street to the fort in all the glories of gold lace and ruffles, drum and fife, and an escort of soldiers. "He came like a peacock with great state and pomp," wrote someone of his arrival. This governor, Peter Stuyvesant, made a speech to the people. "I shall rule you as a father rules his children," he said. They all cheered, for they did not know that he meant that he should do exactly as he chose, and that they must obey him. He began by making laws and seeing to it that they were enforced. He forbade selling liquor to the Indians. Whoever broke this law had to pay for all the damage that the drunken Indian might do. It was forbidden to build any more wooden chimneys. When a house was burned, 4 tire wardens were to look into the matter. If they decided that the owner had been careless, he had to pay a fine besides losing his house. This fine went to help buy hooks and ladders and leather fire buckets for future emergencies. The colony grew fast, and after a while it began to call itself a city. It was a very quiet, village-like little city, even though it was giving up its wooden buildings and thatched roofs. Every citizen who could afford it made the end of his house, which fronted the street, of little yellow and black bricks brought from Holland and arranged in checkerboard fashion. The roofs were gorgeous with yellow and black tiles. These Dutchmen liked plenty of room for themselves and their homes, and everyone wanted to have around his house a garden where he could raise vegetables and flowers and plant the tulip bulbs that came from Holland. He wanted a horse, a cow, some hens, and a pig or two. Every morning the town herdsman drove the cows to pasture, and every night he drove them back, leaving each cow at her own gate and blowing a horn to let her master know she had come. Within the house there was one room that was kept sacred from common use. This was the parlor, and there the household treasures were collected. Carpets had not yet come into use, but fine sand was first sprinkled upon the floor, and then a broom was drawn over it lightly in graceful figures. There was a high-posted bedstead in the parlor, heaped up with a thick feather bed, which only the skillful housewife knew how to make round and smooth. There was a down quilt, and there were heavy curtains and a valance. 2 other pieces of furniture were the special pride of the good housekeeper. One was a solid oaken chest. When the lid was raised, there was a gleam of snowy linen, spun and woven by the busy hands of the women of the household, and bleached on the grass to a dazzling whiteness. The second was a cupboard, always made with glass doors, for its duty was not to hide the silver and porcelain, but to show it. There were no rocking chairs or sofas in the Dutch parlor, or anywhere else in the house for that matter, and how the good people could ever have felt comfortable as they sat up straight and stiff in the leather-covered high-backed chairs is a mystery. The parlor was used on festive occasions only. The kitchen was the homeroom. There was the immense fireplace with pot-hooks and crane. There were dressers with rows of pewter plates and mugs and porringers that must never be allowed to become dull if their mistress hoped to be called a good housekeeper. There was a heavy square dining table, wide and roomy, for the Dutch wives and daughters knew well how to cook delicious dishes, and the husbands and sons knew how to appreciate them. Those early New Yorkers were sociable people, and they did not by any means give all their time to spinning and cooking and planting gardens. There were quiltings and huskings and apple-paring bees. There were birthday parties and weddings. There were parties at New Year and Easter and Christmas and between times. When one was to take place, the gentlemen made themselves gorgeous in their coats of silk or plush or velvet, trimmed with lace and big round silver buttons. These coats came down almost to their ankles. Their shoes were fastened with broad silver buckles. The ladies wore jackets and skirts which were almost as short as the men's coats were long. These skirts were quilted in patterns until they were fairly stiff with the stitching. Below the skirt were home-knit stockings of red or blue or green and high-heeled shoes. Rings and brooches were much worn, but the one ornament that every Dutch lady felt she really could not do without was gold beads, strings upon strings of them to wind about her neck. The great merrymaking of the year was at Christmas. The pilgrims had seen that holiday made the excuse for so much drinking and low amusement in England that they were determined to have no Christmas celebrations. But the Dutch saw no reason why both grown-ups and children should not enjoy the day, or rather days, for one was not nearly enough for the general jollity and merriment. No one did any more work than was really necessary during that time. The night before Christmas, the children all hung up their stockings in the chimney corner. Then they joined hands and sang a song to Santa Claus, which ended, "If you'll to me a present give, I'll serve you truly while I live." As the years passed, there was more silver plate in the houses, and handsomer furniture was brought from Holland. There were velvet chairs, watches, clocks, silken gowns, jewelry, broadcloth suits, embroidered purses, shirts and neckcloths trimmed with lace, and breeches made of silk and flowered with silver and gold. More colonists had come, and New Amsterdam was quite a different place in 1664 from what it had been in 1647 when the whole village turned out to welcome the new governor. For 17 years he had ruled the Dutch town, and he had done well by it, for he was honest and he meant to do what he thought was for the best. He had treated the Indians kindly but firmly, and there had been little trouble with them. Difficulties were soon to appear, however. One day a young man who had just come from Boston to New Amsterdam told the governor some startling news. "King Charles of England has given this land to his brother James, the Duke of York," he said, "and there is a rumor that a fleet of armed vessels is already on the way to take possession of it." Then there was excitement from one end of the Dutch city to the other. The governor bought powder and food and did his best to strengthen his fortifications. He had but 100 soldiers, one little fort, a few guns, and a small supply of powder. The 3-foot wall of earth and the crumbling wooden palisade might help to keep out the arrows of the Indians, but they would be small protection against King Charles's cannonballs. Still, the governor had no thought of surrender. He stumped about from one place to another, giving orders to the men who were working on the fortifications, sometimes encouraging them, sometimes storming at them for their slowness, and stamping angrily with his wooden leg. The fleet came. Colonel Nichols, who was in command, took possession of a blockhouse on Staten Island and landed some of his soldiers on Long Island. Then the governor sent a formal demand to know what this behavior might mean. The colonel, in reply, ordered him to surrender. "Yield peaceably, and I promise freedom and his property to every citizen," he said. Now, New Amsterdam had become so well-to-do that many English had come there to live, and, of course, they preferred to be under the English king. Even the Dutch believed that the company had not treated them fairly, and so they did not feel very unhappy at the thought of having a new ruler. Certainly they would rather live under English rule than have their homes destroyed by English soldiers. The council urged the governor to surrender, but he said no. The citizens begged him to yield. Still he declared, "I won't surrender." While they were talking, Colonel Nichols sent another letter, promising that, if they would yield, the trade with Holland should go on as usual, and settlers should come from that country as freely as ever. The governor knew very well that if the people saw that letter, they would refuse to fight, so he would not read it to them. A rumor then went through the city. The English have sent a letter offering good terms, and a crowd gathered around the council room. Even the men who were at work on the defenses dropped their tools and ran, crying, "The letter! The letter! Show us the letter!" "The letter must be read to them," said the council. "It shall never be," roared the governor, pounding the floor with his wooden leg and tearing the letter into pieces. "Show us the letter," the crowd still called. The secretary picked up the pieces and put them together, and it was read aloud from the steps of the building. The governor wrote a strong, manly reply to Colonel Nichols, saying that the Dutch had discovered New Netherland, had bought it of the Indians, had settled upon it, and surely it belonged to them. He trained his guns on the English ships, and he marched down to the landing, ready with his 100 soldiers to fight 5 or 6 times that number. The ships had 94 guns, and the colonists had about 20. The gunners on the vessels and the gunners on the land stood waiting the signal to fire. Then a paper was brought to the governor, signed by all the principal citizens, his own son among them, begging him not to allow the destruction of the town. Women crowded about him, weeping and praying him to save their homes. Little children clung to him and cried, "Save us! Save us!" "I would rather be carried out to my grave," cried the dauntless governor. But he was helpless, for the people refused to obey his orders. The white flag of surrender was finally run up, and the governor marched out of the fort at the head of his men, with flags flying and drums beating. Down on the shore, the English soldiers were already drawn up in line, and soon the English flag was floating over Fort Amsterdam, which now became Fort James. The town had saved its houses, but it had lost its name. It was no longer New Amsterdam, but in honor of the Duke of York, it was called New York, and Colonel Nichols became its governor. Whether the town was English or Dutch, Governor Stuyvesant had no idea of leaving it. He owned a large bowery or farm, and there he spent his last years. He had fine horses and cattle and the best of fruit trees. He had a prim flower garden laid out in stiff regular beds. Behind the garden was the roomy 2-story house to which he delighted to welcome his friends, and among them was his old enemy, Colonel Nichols.